Good morning, and
no, we won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No, we won't take it.
Good morning, and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show. I'm Tom Hopka, filling in for Sarah Schultz, and on the air with me this morning is my co-host, Bill Dovey.
Good morning, everyone.
And our first
Tom, how
guest
are you doing
this morning,
today?
I'm great. How are you, Bill?
Excellent. I guess I'll go ahead and say that, yes, this is the Sarah Schultz Show. Unfortunately, Sarah cannot be with us today because she is quite ill. So in place of Sarah, one woman, we have two men doing the job of one woman. So, Tom, thank you for hosting today. And go ahead, and what else do you have to say?
Well, I just want to thank Sarah for the opportunity to fill in today, and I hope she's feeling well soon. And I think we'll have a great show today. We've got a really good lineup of guests. And, Bill, why don't you introduce our first guest? He's already on with us.
Yes, good morning. Yuri, how are you today?
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, Tom. How are you doing, gentlemen?
Good. Thank you.
Great.
Good morning.
And Yuri, right. just for the sake of our guests and listeners, if you wouldn't mind just saying again, you know, who you are and what you are currently doing.
Sure. Let's see. Well, my name is Yuri Rashkin. I'm pretty sure about that. That's an easy one. And
that's
then
what I heard.
And then I wear lots of different hats. So I'm trying to kind of keep the ones that are relevant to the conversation at hand. So, first of all, I'm a publisher and I run Defend Wisconsin News Roundup. It's a Facebook page and it's also a blog. And originally I started doing it in about mid-February when all the protests started because I felt like I didn't want to start sharing all of this information that was coming out just like a volcano of news. I didn't want to start sharing on my, you know, main Facebook page. I started a blog where I was collecting things and putting them out as daily news roundups. Pretty soon, I set up a Defend Wisconsin News Roundup Facebook page, and so now we're kind of, you know, I have those two working together, and on the website you can find a list of headlines, which is kind of what we're going to talk about today, or the headlines roundup, but also you can find some of the original editorials from our local writers. I am headquartered in Janesville, so that's where I find the local voices that I'm trying to give a little bit more opportunity to express themselves. And we've got some great writers that have emerged, in particular Vivian Creekmore with her Vivian's Love Letters that she's been sending out and posting on Facebook to all sorts of people that probably don't get too much love, and for good reason, but she is hilarious, and I highly recommend to anyone who's looking for a good laugh at a political level to check out Vivian's Love Letters. Besides Defend Wisconsin News Roundup, I suppose I should mention that I'm also running for the Assembly to represent the 44th District, which is pretty much all of Janesville, and I'm honored to currently serve as Vice President of Janesville City Council. So I think that covers a couple of my hats.
You know, Yuri, I guess in many ways, given the current political climate, you'd be considered a slacker. You don't do enough.
Well, I was kind of reassured that I'm not alone in this wearing several hats attitude when I was reading the article about Nick Nice, who is a DJ in Madison and also a full-time protester. And so this is kind of something that all of this information probably should be forwarded to Scott Walker, who thinks that all of these people that are, you know, gathering signatures and protesting are being paid by somebody, because, you know, we're doing this because it's the right thing to do. We're not doing this for the money. And I think that's something that probably Scott Walker, you know, should be let know. But I do also several other things that actually make me a little bit of money, and I'm a working musician, which is nice, and I teach at Madison Media Institute. So I'm
really,
yes, not to mention, I suppose I should mention that I also work as an interpreter in Wisconsin courts, because because I am bilingual. I speak Russian and English. I was born in Moscow, Russia, and I came to the United States about 25 years ago when I was 13. So, see, it's just
well, that's wonderful.
Diversity of half. That is correct. I must say, I've never been on a show that was co-hosted by two people, both on phones, and then a third guest on the phone. This is great. We got this high technology thing happening. I love it.
It's great, isn't it?
It is. It's very high tech.
So, Yuri, what do you have to share with us today?
Well, we have several news that have happened over the last week. It's been surprisingly busy. I suspect that things maybe have slowed down a little bit around the holidays. But now in the last week, the news are just coming out fast and furious. Probably the main news that everybody's talking about is that on Thursday, Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm announced the arrest and charging of three people stemming from an ongoing investigation. Interestingly, and this is coming to us via Cognizant Dissidents blog, these included Tim Russell, who was charged with two felony counts of embezzlement and one misdemeanor charge of embezzlement. Also charged were Kevin Kamenoff for one count of felony embezzlement, four counts of felony fraudulent writings, and Brian Prierig for two very disturbing felony charges, one for child enticement and one for exposing genitals or pubic area. I mean, it starts in politics and then it just goes way beyond that. So that, obviously, the internet's been buzzing about that one.
And speaking of the internet buzz on this, what is, what's the general sense that you have picked up on the internet buzz as far as how this may or may not affect Walker and the Republicans running for office in the state?
Well, there's obviously every story is going to have at least three sides to it, and it sounds like Scott Walker right now is publicly embracing the results of the investigation. After all, what can he do? Perhaps he's advised that this would give him some wiggle room when further news erupts. So who knows? And I think that people are just going to start distancing themselves from these folks that were arrested for obvious reasons. But at the same time, we should not forget that these people have very close ties to the governor. I believe one of them was involved with operating his website. I mean, we really had some very close business dealings. The other side, Tim Russell, had used some of the money that he had allegedly pilfered to buy a number of websites, one of which was his realty business. The other ones were for apparent political use, including one that is very familiar to many, Milwaukee County Executive Scott Walker for governor, and official Walker campaign sign, scottforgov.com. So there's some very close interaction there, and that should not be ignored.
At what point do you think the PR damage of this will start to catch up with him? So far, Scott Walker's PR machine has been doing, pains me to say it, a very good job of putting a positive veneer on so much of what he has done thus far. And in the light of all these criminal charges and investigations coming forward, I'm just wondering, at what point do you think there will be that threshold moment where the PR veneer is going to wear off and people are going to start seeing it for what it is?
You know, I think that, Tom, the situation is that those that listen to Scott Walker and his PR machine live in a pretty much different universe than those who do not. There's very little interaction. It kind of goes back to the same MSNBC versus Fox News situation where you have a group of people who listen to one news source that gives them a consistent news information that is consistent within itself. So I think that just kind of going back to the same thing that we saw when there was a Valerie Plame situation with George W. Bush when she was outed as a CIA agent, how long did it take for those, for everybody to really catch on to the fact that there were some crimes committed? And it probably doesn't hurt to have some convictions and plea agreements that are pretty hard to deny even in a campaign commercial. So I guess we should have to let the justice system work its way through. Speaking of the justice system, we have judge rules against Wisconsin Dems intervention in GOP recall lawsuit. That's moving forward. Jersey, a judge in Wisconsin ruled that Democratic recall organizers cannot challenge a lawsuit brought by the state GOP against election officials, a suit which claims that Governor Scott Walker's constitutional rights are being violated by the state petition review process. That's a bit of interesting news. But at the same time, Wisconsin Supreme Court is asked by a prosecutor to reopen collective bargaining lawsuit because of much excitement with Justice Gableman, who received free legal services from the company that was hired by the state to defend the law. So a very small circle of friends they have over there, which is kind of the same people that help everybody, and so it creates obvious conflict of interest, and now we're looking at a possibility of having the collective bargaining lawsuit reopened altogether, which would be probably a really good thing.
Outstanding. And as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the way this works, wouldn't Gableman be forced to abstain from the case because of this conflict of interest? I know that was discussed at one point.
I think those are questions that would be great to ask an attorney, but there's certainly hope that a justice that would so obviously have a conflict of interest would not be involved in deciding a case before them. What ethics and rules the Supreme Court of Wisconsin abides by is an excellent question for a constitutional attorney, and I would think that considering the amount of news that's coming out that are connected to the justice system, that would be an excellent person to find to interview. What I'm seeing here is that the best thing that journalists can do is just pump the information out there and force questions to be asked and ask questions themselves. Because that's, you know, I think it was Justice Louis Brandeis who said that sunshine is the best disinfectant. That's kind of where we're at with what we're doing, is just getting some sunshine on all of this and hope that qualified people will ask some qualified questions.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to ask you very briefly, one of the things that Republicans have been almost giddily talking about is the prospect that if the recall becomes more of a reality, they can effectively sidestep it by having Scott Walker resign and let Rebecca Clayfish ascend to the governorship. And I know there have been some legal debates about this taking place in the news, with some attorneys saying maybe that would work, but many others saying no, because of the two petitions, it would encompass them both, and that strategy would not serve the Republicans well. And I just wondered if you've heard anything about that or have any take on it.
Well, to me, that's just another more politics of desperation, because if they're talking about having Lieutenant Governor Clayfish become effectively a governor, this person that has been barely vetted by anybody for anything, and the whole discussion prior to the election was, do we really need to have a lieutenant governor? The position serves no purpose whatsoever unless the governor is not able to fulfill, you know, their duties for some unknown reason, apparently such as recall. This is not a person that has really anybody's trust. And I think that's why, wisely, we've been gathering petitions for both of them from the beginning. Just because I don't think that having a governor or Clayfish is anybody's idea of a good time. So hopefully that this is one of those rumors that just doesn't pan out. I think that would get people pretty angry, and I don't think that would serve any good purpose, obviously, in the state. Catching up on some of the other things that are happening over the last week, Scott Walker was named Governor of the Year, which I think is something that, if you look just a little bit closer under that thin layer of veneer of Governor of the Year, it turns out that the magazine that promoted that and gave this award to the governor has, I think, 50 readers, which are the governors, and it's published by a gentleman, I think, out of his own home. So it's not, you know, Academy Awards, but I think it's important to highlight that. And even though the man himself, Dean Pagani, who publishes this, admits that this is not necessarily because Scott Walker was the best governor of the year, but because he had the greatest impact and probably has the, you know, best name recognition of just about any governor over the last 12 months in the United States. If we don't bring sunshine to this and point out the real insignificance and the meaning of this award, you can count on the fact that Scott Walker is going to be promoting this in his advertisements, saying, look, I've been named Governor of the Year. So it's, again, I think just important to shine some light on.
Agreed.
Well, Yuri, on that disturbing note, we're going to have to say goodbye until next week. And on behalf of Sarah, myself, and Tom, thank you very much for appearing today. It was fun speaking with you.
You're most welcome, guys. Have a good time. Take care. Good luck to Sarah.
Great. Thank Bye-bye. You. Take care, Yuri. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Yuri.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going to be having our next guest, who is one of southeastern Wisconsin's noted and well-regarded activists. He has been an activist since 1948. He'll tell us a little something about when he got started in all of this. But primarily, our next guest, Eugene Borufkin, will be talking about his experience, his recent experience, with his visit out to Oakland, California, and visiting with the Occupy Oakland people. Eugene, do I have that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I was there from December 3rd to December 13th.
Well, first off, if you want, you can certainly add a little more about your bio, and then please tell us about your visit out to Oakland.
Okay. I moved to this area, to the Milwaukee area, 2.5 years ago from North Carolina, where I lived for 15 years. And before that, I mostly lived and was brought up in New York City and Connecticut. In 1948, my first political activity was marching for Henry Wallace in New York City, who ran on the Progressive Party ticket. And I just looked it up the other day. At the same time, the Progressive Party was always on the ballot here in Wisconsin. Many states had a prominent Progressive Party to balance out the ticket with Democrats. And I've been at it ever since. My mother instilled certain things in me, especially health care, which is my favorite advocacy issue. And I always put a plug in, we need Medicare for everybody. If we had Medicare for everybody, we would not be going through so much of what we're going through right now, even with Walker and cutting Medicaid and Badger Care.
Well, you know, in the future, we're going to have a show on health care, and we definitely plan to have you on to speak to that issue.
Great.
But now on to your visit out to Oakland. What was your take on that, and how do you see it integrated or not integrated into the greater Occupy movement, and how does it relate or not relate to what is going on here in Wisconsin?
Those are the great questions, and I've been discussing those questions with other people who have been observing and who are organizers. But the very first thing that struck me when I got there one afternoon was the grass area in front of Oakland City Hall, where all this goes on, was muddy and wet, and the sprinklers were on low. What happened was, since the great debacle there back in November, they keep the whole middle grass area muddy. And I just went on Google Images and looked at Oakland City Hall. And you can see how beautiful it is, the grass and everything, when it's kept up. But I think to keep the people from pitching their tents in the larger area, what they've done now is they keep it muddy. So now the tents and the Occupy people are using the perimeter of this park, which is at least 10 acres. It is really a very, very large area. And the tents are pitched, and people are sitting around and standing around on the steps of this amphitheater type park in front of City Hall, and they're on the hard ground rather than on the soft ground on the grass and soil. So, and the other first thing that struck me when I got out of my car was that there were no police around. There must have been 400 or 500 people there, and there were just a few private security people. And then thinking about that and looking at pictures and talking to other people, it turned out that everybody realized it was a police presence that was inflaming the situation. So as the police and Mayor Bloomberg actually said in New York, they made a mistake by kicking everybody out of Zuccotti Park, because when they were in the park, they weren't marching up and down the streets and the sidewalks and the entrances to the subways and just stopping everything dead. So people didn't know what to do at the beginning, which was very interesting. It was extremely effective after, as most people pointed out, about the sixth week in New York. And after that, people started saying, well, what's more effective, what's less effective, what's causing problems, what's not causing problems. And the biggest cause of the problems was police presence.
Well, and you just touched on something very important, because that was something that all of us saw play out here, were the incidents of some fairly violent clashes between the police and the Occupy movement late last year. And that was something I was hoping you could comment on, is how have things changed from the shocking images we saw on the news of protesters being injured to where things are now? What would you say the climate is like, and what changes do you think you've seen?
I'm pretty sure I haven't heard too many legislators talk about it at any level. They realize the police were causing a problem. Police really aren't there anymore, unless to control traffic or something. If it's around rush hour and a lot of people and stuff like that, which is understandable, and they realize the Occupy people are on their side, especially the police themselves. It's the same way with the Walker recall. We get smiles and waves in and around Brookfield and Waukesha now. The majority of the people realize that this is all for their better good, and I'm sure the tide has turned. And what everybody really needs to watch is continually get online to the Occupy Washington, D.C. people. On the 27th, as an example, there's a massive Occupy, all the congressional buildings, the three office buildings and Congress and the Capitol building itself and all the streets. We don't hear about these things. A lot of people, even when I was in Oakland, somebody stopped me and said, what's going on in Washington? Because I had gotten up and said why I was there and I was a visitor and all that. And they said, why isn't there more going on in Washington? This is what people, right in Oakland, which was amazing. And I really didn't know at the time. I had heard about the hunger strike starting by the Occupy people in Washington. Now, how many people know about that? There's a big hunger strike going on in Washington, D.C., Occupy. Nobody knows about it. But, yeah, so you have to get on their website. And that prompted me to look at their website almost every day. And they've had massive protests in Washington, D.C., and the press just is not covering it. I don't know if they're not covering it because of the primaries and they want to spend time on that, or they're just really being held back by the people on the right and the people who own many of the newspapers and the TV networks. But even MSNBC, who seems to be pretty much have a free hand, they're not covering Washington, D.C. Occupy, and we need to push that one. And then the other question about organizing and the interaction between them, there is none too little. Except for Twitter and Facebook. I did not know that there was an ongoing Occupy Berkeley, which is like 4 miles away from Occupy Oakland. And then, of course, the big Occupy San Francisco, where the second week in December, there were a whole bunch of people arrested for days and days and days. The three of them do not talk to each other. In fact, one woman in Oakland said, "Gee, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And she said to me, "You know, my daughter goes to Berkeley, and she said I'm over here." And the question I said, "So, hey, are you here and not helping your daughter at Occupy Berkeley?" And she said, "I like the issues here better than the issues there."
Well, hey, Eugene, you made a point earlier about the police in Oakland, and you made a point that seems to have been glossed over by mainstream media and many others, for that matter, in that the police have recognized that the protesters are actually on their side. So how did you what did you see that made you come to that realization?
Just body language, just by looking at their faces and in their hands in pictures that are on the media, and you'll see they're basically standing around looking bored and doing nothing, and in some cases smiling. It was just like a year ago in Madison, on the biggest protest day of all for Walker, and it was snowing and cold and wet, and the police were helping people get up and down the steps to the Capitol building, making sure they didn't slip. They were holding the elbows and arms of older people. And then when I got down to the street, the police were helping to hand out the slices of pizza. You know, it had turned around from the very first a week or 2 weeks of occupying Madison, which we really did. And to the police were saying, "Hey, they're on our side because our take-home pay is going to be cut just like all the other public service workers. We'll be taking home less money. Those people are fighting for us." And they realized that they're all part of the middle class, whether they're part of the lower middle class, middle class, or upper middle class, depending on their rank. You got to remember, there are some police captains and all making over $80,000 to $120,000 a year. So we're on their side, and I think that their chief of police, their chief of the fire department, their chief of whatever, have realized that this is good for their staff, for their people, because their people will be happier, and their people aren't happy, like the case of teachers, who, by the way, I found out, are taking home around $400 a month less in Wisconsin. The teacher with a family health care policy is taking home $400 a month less without contribution and the retirement contribution, pension contribution. So it comes down to dollars and cents, though. It comes down to dollars and cents like so many other things. And sometimes it just takes too long for people to realize it. But because this is going on so long, more and more people are realizing it, and it's working better and better, even though it's not getting the press we need it to get. And I told Tom last night on the telephone regarding the Walker's legal problems that Walker yesterday at the press conference in Washington, D.C., said he did not he was sure that the actual recall election will be in June. And I said, "Hooray, we have another month," you know. If they start going to court about this and they delaying it, it gives us more time. And I don't think they've realized yet that it would be better for them. They have more money right now than we do, and then we're going to start getting more money. We're going to organize better than they do. And it's the same way with the Occupy. As more and more people look at it and realize the points being made, it gets better and better for our side.
Good. Well, speaking of organization, What? And I know that you said that the groups out in California were not speaking to one another. How do you see that translating to what is going on in the Occupy movement here in Wisconsin? And, I mean, is there a decent amount of outreach? Is there not enough? Is it misdirected? What do you think?
This was one of the first things I noticed, because Bill Ruckert and I were trying to help the Madison Occupy people. And Bill had written a letter to them because he had visited them a couple of times and then asked me to help and chime in. The outreach was in one direction. They were sitting around, all the Occupy groups, as far as I know, they all have an outreach committee, and they were sitting there waiting for people to come to them, and they would welcome them. They were not going out to the organizations to ask them to help them. And then Bob Snyder, a friend of ours, noticed the same thing in Occupy Milwaukee. So now he went to Common Ground University, which is like Wallstone, like Camp Wallstone. So he went through 12 hours of training with them, and one of the things they point out to people is you've got to go out and find the people you want to help you. And so it dawned on him that the Milwaukee Occupy people were doing the same thing that Bill noticed in Madison. So when I got out there, I asked them, the Oakland people, and it was the same thing. And I asked them why. And they said, well, we do everything by consensus, and we have to have an agreement first. And so if they were going to contact, which is happening right now, the NAACP is getting very much involved. Anybody can go on the Internet and look that up, which is very good. But, again, the NAACP is going to the individual Occupy groups. The Occupy groups didn't go to the NAACP. So it took longer to get off the ground because of this. So, and I was talking to Sarah about this yesterday, and she had mentioned to me she had gone down to Chicago Occupy very early on, and she noticed the same thing. She noticed it months ago in Chicago. So we know it. It's not something that that we just made up or imagined, because I found it in Oakland, Madison, Milwaukee, and Chicago. It must be every place. And it's kind of a joke. You can go to a GA and they could spend 10, 15 minutes discussing where to put the garbage pails. And for the most part, these people have never done any protesting before. Or if they have, they never did the organizing for the protesting. And they really don't know how to point out what's most important, and let's discuss the important issues first. Then we'll get to where to put the garbage pails. But I was standing there astounded how long it took them to discuss the garbage pails.
Interesting.
Well,
usually we have about 2 minutes left. Tom, do you have any questions for Eugene? And Eugene, is there anything else that you want to say before time is up?
Tom, you there?
Yep. For my point, I just wanted to thank you for making the point that this is still going on, because I've heard that in conversations with people just in my day-to-day interactions, wondering why the Occupy movement is dying down. And that's kind of a perception some people have, just because of the way the mainstream media is not covering what's happening.
Yeah,
so I think it's great that you brought that
to light. One more point on issues that people keep bringing out. Why aren't they doing a better job on coordinating across the country on issues other than the 99% versus the 1%, which maybe is the only issue they should concentrate on? And two of the big occupies in the Oakland, San Francisco area, the one at Berkeley and the one at UC Davis, the Occupy was only because of the increase in tuition. It was an Occupy against the California Regents. And that pepper spray issue that made all these headlines, they were sitting there because of their tuitions. They were not there because of the 99% versus the 1%. So some of the occupies are organized for very specific, localized reasons, and people like some of the national organizers, like Rogers, are trying to get them connected so to be a national movement, and the Occupy people are resisting it. They don't want it. They really don't. They want to be independent. They want to be working by consensus with their own group.
Very good. Well, on that note, we will have to let you go. Eugene, we'd like to have you back again, and thank you so much.
Sure.
We're going to be going to a break at this point. When we come back, we will be talking to Ray Yunker from United Wisconsin. So thanks, everybody.
Okay.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We don't think it's an exaggeration to say that people could literally freeze to death in their homes as a result of this corporate decision.
USW Local 101 Vice President Jim Savage talking about possible home heating oil supply disruptions from the closing of three refineries in the Philadelphia area. Sunoco and ConocoPhillips plan to close three refineries and replace the product from those plants with imports. USW says losing these three refineries will also diminish the ability to make up losses in case Gulf Coast refineries are again disabled by hurricanes. USW Local 10234 President Dennis Stefano says that about 1,400 United Steelworker jobs will be destroyed, along with hundreds of building trades and management jobs, and local government and schools will lose millions of dollars. The union wants to keep the refineries open.
The very companies that are shutting down our refineries right now are the ones that are going to be importing, putting us out of work and replacing our good middle-class paying jobs with imported product. Before any more refineries are shut down in the United States, we absolutely believe Congress should require the CEOs, people making the decisions to close these refineries down, to come before Congress and explain why they're being shut down.
The attack is on the working people, and the attack is against collective bargaining, whether it's private or public workers. We're under attack right now.
International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 21 President Dan Kaufman says his union is determined to fight the EGT company to the bitter end as the company tries to bust the ILWU at the Port of Longview in Washington State. Kaufman says the ILWU will meet a grain ship expected to come into the port soon in an effort to stop it from being loaded with non-union labor. ILWU and the local Central Labor Council in the Longview area have put out a labor call to action to make sure the ship is met by a massive protest. Kaufman says ILWU supported Wisconsin's worker uprising to defend public worker collective bargaining, and he vows ILWU will keep fighting the ongoing attacks on the union rights of workers.
The ILWU said, we've had enough. I know the people of Wisconsin said, we have had enough, and we're fighting back.
The Washington Education Association has won a lawsuit in which they accused the legislature of violating the Constitution by not properly funding the state's public education system. Jesse Russell reports.
The state Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that the legislature isn't doing enough and criticized the body for discussing reforms while making substantial cuts to education. Writing for the majority, Justice Deborah Stevens said the court wouldn't stand by as the legislature makes unfulfilled promises. The court has given lawmakers until 2018 to put reforms in place in an attempt to curtail what has become a pattern of moving the reform deadline further down the road. The ruling by the Washington State Supreme Court echoes a similar decision in 1978, which the court used as precedent for making such a demand of the legislature.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
All right. Thank you for coming back with us. And we are going on the air with Ray Yunker of United Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for being with us. What can you do to bring us up to speed on the latest in the recall efforts?
Well, we're very excited at the outpouring of volunteerism and passion around the recall of Governor Walker and Rebecca Clefish. And we're just really excited to move into the next phase, and we're getting ready to collect our last rounds of signatures and then turn them into the Government Accountability Board on the 17th and move into the next phase of
of the recall, and that's the verification of those signatures, followed by the calling of election, and then all of the campaigns, which will be obviously a very interesting time in the state of Wisconsin.
This is history in the making.
Absolutely. It's only the third time in the United States history that a sitting governor has been recalled. I personally am excited about the fact that this has been done almost exclusively with volunteer petitions.
That's the point I'd like to have you address. I apologize for interrupting, but I would like to have you address this point because this came up earlier in the show. But one of the Republicans' favorite taglines, and the two people I've heard it most from, have been Scott Walker and, well, actually, let's be fair, both Fitzgerald brothers, saying that, well, this is being done by employed persons, people who are being paid to go out and get signatures. That's their favorite tagline, and they've been putting that out
and
there
unions.
As much as they can. Yes,
and unions.
I can't tell you that there aren't union members volunteering within our organization. I know that there are. I can't tell you how many there are or what percentage they are. We don't keep track of those things. We're a grassroots and we're a nonpartisan organization, and we are not a puppet or a slave to either the unions or the Democratic Party. We've worked in concert with them because we have a mutual goal, and that's the removal of Scott Walker from office. I know there. I will not tell. We have some paid staff because this is just the most huge task managing all of this. And I know that the Democrats have staff in the field offices that they've paid, but they're not going out as paid canvassers. They're mostly processing the paperwork as it comes in and as it goes out. We are, you know, it is just, you know, the boots on the ground organization is volunteer. It just absolutely is. I challenge anyone to go through our records at any point and look and see that. It is clear that we are a volunteer-driven organization. We are funded by individual contributions, almost 90% from in-state. So
I can tell you. Well, Ray, I can tell you that the volunteers who have been working extremely hard on this, taking time away from their family lives, devoting their spare time, you know, getting out into the inclement weather, appreciate the fact that the emphasis is on volunteers and not this divisive rhetoric that comes from Walker and the Fitzgeralds claiming that this effort is only by the union organizations in order to draw a contrast between the amount of money that is pouring in that Walker and Fitzgeralds are getting from outside sources in order to hold on to their public welfare seats that they're so, you know, apt to go ahead and want to get other people from government employees to get, you know, to take major cuts, but they're certainly willing to spend, in Fitzgerald's case, 20 years on the public dole, and in many instances, not really having done anything for his constituency, except a very small constituency. So again, thank you for noting the volunteers.
I personally, and I know I can speak for the board and tell you that we, every day we talk about and are amazed and are so thankful for our volunteers and what they've done and what they've accomplished. This is their effort. We always will joke about how much of this is out of our control. We just try and listen to what our volunteers and the people that pledged with us early on, what their wishes are, because they are this organization. They are why we will be successful in turning in these petitions. We can't say enough thanks to our volunteers for that.
Well, and if I may, there is a question that came up earlier, and I was just hoping you could address this. The Republicans, many of them have been floating different ideas for sidestepping this, and of course you've seen their attempts to attack the signature gathering and signature evaluation process, but the other thing that keeps coming up is the notion that if we do acquire the necessary number of signatures, and it appears that we are on course to recall Scott Walker. They could have him resign, and Rebecca Clayfish could ascend to the governorship and thereby avert this whole recall process. And I've heard some lawyers say they think that may have merit and that it might work, but several others have said no, because we're using the two petitions, that strategy would fail, and there is no legal standing for it. And I just wonder, is that something your organization has looked at, and has there been any in-house conversation about that?
Actually, it is something we looked at, and we looked at it a long time ago back. It was one of many factors in early October as we were deciding when to file a petition. That played a big role in it, among several other items, but we did look into that very question. And we were told that it's very clear that once the petitions are filed, you can't get out of the recall by resigning. It's there is supposed to be some form of protection from that by the nature of filing the recall. Because that, you know, technically the concern was that he would do it before we filed. That was what we were concerned about, and that's what, one of the reasons we chose to go in November, because there was some thought of going probably about another 4 weeks from now. Those were really the two time frames we were considering, and that did play a role in deciding our date. I know it did. We discussed it at length for a long time, but it is not a factor at this point. They cannot. At least according to what we've been told by legal counsel, they cannot resign and move her up so that she gets another year. That doesn't work. And I think at this point, the outrage would just, I don't know that anybody could, I mean, there's a point where you can change the rules so much for yourself. And I think people, that's one of the reasons we feel that the response to our petition and the signature collection has been as strong as it has, is because people have seen these tricks, and even Republicans and right-leaning independents are signing this.
Yeah, so. This is unprecedented. And I thank your organization for all you're doing to pull this together. We have just a moment left before we have to take our next segment. Can you tell people where they can go if they still have yet to volunteer and want to climb on board?
Well, yes, I do have some important dates I'd like everyone to know about.
Sure.
Number one, on January 10th, that'll be the last day anyone who has a petition with signatures on it can submit it by mail. On Friday, the 13th of next week, will be the last day to deliver the signatures to the offices. We will be processing on the 14th, 15th, and 16th through the signatures and getting them ready to go to Gab on the 17th. I would ask, if you know who your United Wisconsin County coordinator is, please find them. You can find them on our website or by calling or interacting with our website to find your local United Wisconsin county chairperson or county coordinator, and they will help you get involved in any way they can.
Okay.
We are literally, there'll be a few offices open on the 14th, and then that will be it. We have to get the signatures processed and in. So I highly encourage people to do that.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for being with us today, and we would love to have you back again.
Absolutely. We look forward to it, and we're real excited about the 17th. Everybody keep their eyes peeled.
We sure will. Thanks for all you're doing.
You bet. Take care.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can grab off our website over at progressive.org. Good news on the Citizens United front. On Wednesday, the New York City Council voted to urge Congress to pass a constitutional amendment overturning the horrendous Citizens United decision. You know, the one that the Supreme Court handed down 2 years ago that says corporations are persons and can spend as much money as they want to elect this candidate or defeat that one. New York joins L.A. and a few smaller city and county boards in denouncing Citizens United as the threat to democracy that it is. Then out in Montana, the state Supreme Court there just defied the U.S. Supreme Court by upholding a century-old law banning corporate spending in state and local races. This sets up a collision with the Roberts Court at some point, and we can only hope that by then one of the conservatives on the court will be gone and replaced by a liberal. But I'm not betting on that. Far better to amend the Constitution so that whoever sits on the Supreme Court, corporations will be banned from buying elections. So get your city or town to go on record for this constitutional amendment. Let's follow New York and L.A. and build this movement for real democracy in America. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Well, thank you all. We're back again, and our next guest is Mr. Dick Poss. Dick is the was a two-time candidate for the Wisconsin State Assembly and is currently the chair of the Waukesha County Democratic Party. Dick is a resident of Wisconsin, having grown up in Bayview and Wauwatosa. Got his BA degree in economics from Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Is a graduate of the Wisconsin University of Wisconsin Law School, former captain in the U.S. Army Reserves, former counsel of the U.S. Small Business Administration, and my God, he was a business owner as a Democrat, and also a former economic analyst for the Congressional Research Service. Mr. Poss, how are you?
I am terrific. Good morning, all. It's a great Friday in Wisconsin.
Thanks
yes,
for joining us.
Yes, Dick, and we have you on for the sole purpose of talking about a subject matter that is near and dear to you, and that is about a point that I had addressed earlier with, or I made a comment earlier to Ray Younger about the divisiveness that exists in Wisconsin. And a lot of that divisiveness can be attributed to the messaging and communications that takes place in our on our, may I say, dare say, public airwaves, especially with regard to toxic communication. So that's a point that you would like to address. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It strikes me as we take a historical look back, it may make sense to look at U.S. government policy relative to what goes out over the airwaves. Back in 1949, the Fairness Doctrine was established. It survived a Supreme Court challenge in 1969, but in 1987, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, in a 4-0 vote, abolished the Fairness Doctrine. There were efforts to reinstate it, but none of those have been successful. It perhaps is no coincidence that 1988 was the first year that a radio host went national. Rush Limbaugh first went national in 1988, and I don't think it's unfair to say that the quality of life in America has ever been the same. In popular vernacular, we often hear the radio label talk radio being applied to various segments of, on the airwaves, but we really have now what certainly accurately could be labeled extreme opinion radio. It is, it's divisive. It could easily be described as resentment radio, disparagement radio, political message radio. There are a broad range of labels that could be applied with accuracy, but the effect on the American political life, civic life, social life has certainly been a sharp decline. Now, the way we talk
if
about
I may interrupt.
Oh, sure, by all means.
Only because you have such a wealth of information that you're relating, but What you have just described certainly begs the question, was there some nefarious intent in doing away with the fairness doctrine? Because you alluded to the fact that the quality of life in America has gone down since 1988. Do you see that there is a co-opting of the messaging in our culture for a particular purpose?
At the current time, certainly in terms of how radio time is divided up, there certainly is something of that nature going on. What we have seen since Rush Limbaugh have been numerous sound-alike hosts, and it certainly covers an appreciable portion of the national and local airtime. It's hard to imagine even casual observers anywhere thinking that other than that we have declined civility and often highly divisive, bitter debates now over public policy issues. It certainly wasn't the United States that that I recall before extreme opinion radio became a broad portion of the American airways.
Dick, could you stay with us? We're in a moment. We're going to be heading into a break, and we'd like to pick you up after that break and continue this discussion. But before the break, I do just want to point out, I thank you for the way you summarized this discussion, because this is something that many people simply are not aware of. People take it for granted because right-wing talk radio is so prevalent, and the background you just provided is something that many Americans simply aren't informed about, and it's something that we need to get out there.
I'll hold.
Thanks so much.
Well, we're back, and we're back with Mr. Dick Poss talking about toxic communication in our society. So, Dick, please continue on with what you were discussing.
Sure. Ironically, it may be our conservative colleagues who most are damaged by extreme opinion radio. For example, is it conservative to endlessly pump the idea that human activity on our globe is not a cause of what we have seen in terms of some of the warmest years on record recently? Is it conservative for extreme opinion radio to rail against producing ethanol here in the upper Midwest, keeping those energy dollars here rather than heading overseas? Is it conservative to trot out every conceivable argument against a high-speed rail system being built right here in Wisconsin, connecting our two largest cities? Is it conservative, is it beneficial to our conservative colleagues in any way to have extreme opinion radio cheerleading an unpaid-for war? Is there anything conservative or beneficial in how extreme opinion radio was a supporter of the Bush-Cheney economic policies that turned surpluses and literally a projected end of a paying off of our national debt into the huge soaring deficits in the economic wreckage that ended the Bush-Cheney administration? Is it conservative to rail against clean air and water? As an entire country, we have much to lose by unrestrained, self-appointed extreme radio hosts asserting and becoming the voice of conservatives. For our country to function, we need two political parties fully capable of good ideas, fully capable of good governance. And certainly Democrats. I grew up as a Republican in a Republican household, but Republicans and Democrats alike have so much to lose by extreme opinion radio dominating the airwaves.
If I may interrupt, you are not alone in that philosophical and political transition. Could you just relate to the audience what made you change from being a Republican to a Democrat?
It was many things over many years. My dad was a friend of Governor Warren Knowles, one of Wisconsin's Republican governors, not that many years ago. And their governance had a light touch. It had a collegial touch. It had a open to ideas from any source aspect to it. I think extreme opinion radio has been a driving force in taking that from us. The days of, for example, the Knowles Nelson Outdoor Recreation Acquisition Program, a bipartisan effort broadly supported. It's what provides public lands for present and future Wisconsin generations. That is very much a target of current government, Wisconsin's current government, which actually in many ways I think is parroting the worst of some of the worst ideas on extreme opinion radio.
Well, and Dick, I'd like to intervene in the discussion just for a moment and have you address a couple of points about toxic talk radio. And there's two aspects of it that I find uniquely damaging. First of all of us are entitled to our own opinions. However, none of us should be entitled to our own facts. And what I find with toxic talk radio is that quite often hosts come onto the air and they simply are spouting information that is not factually correct. They're going beyond the point of voicing an opinion and straying into the airspace of putting out information that is just factually incorrect. And I'm saying that as politely as I can. The other thing that I find truly damaging about it is the rhetoric is so heated that it takes people to a place where they are beyond the capacity for rational thought. And I've seen that in people I know personally who have become addicted to toxic talk radio. They have it in their office, they have it in their car, and they are so brainwashed and emotionally fired up that they are past the point where they can, in a civil and objective manner, sit down and look at an issue, exercising their own independent thought and intelligence, or engage in a discussion with a panel of people like us and sort through the facts of an issue and arrive at a meaningful opinion. And I just was hoping you could talk about those two facets of toxic talk radio.
Both, sadly, they characterize much of extreme opinion radio. When one hears Rush Limbaugh saying that there has been no obstruction of legislation in the U.S. Senate, one knows one isn't not only in inaccuracy land, one's in Alice in Wonderland with regard to reality and political fact. The heated nature of how pumped up talk radio often is capable of inciting, and I don't think that's an inaccurate word, its listeners is right here in Waukesha County at the petition gathering sites. The dozens and dozens of upraised middle fingers, the profane shouts coming the way of mothers, grandmothers. You know, frankly, that's activity that wouldn't be tolerated in any other setting, but talk radio is there. I was at the 83 and 94 site, for example, on the first day of petition gathering, and it was astounding how many voices said, get a job. Could it have been that the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Dick, you raised... This is an interesting point because... I would assume, too, that not only are you alluding to national talk radio, but local talk radio, primarily that which comes from Milwaukee and Madison. And those radio personnel would certainly say that they are not telling people to go out and do goofy, nefarious things to the recall people to deny them their right to express their opinion, their voice in a what appears to be a democracy still. So then how is it that these people are reacting so? Because what the toxicity of the statements being made by, on the national and state level must be resonating with some core values within certain individuals that causes them to take extreme action.
Yes, indeed. But the inaccuracy, the absence of truth or the whole picture is certainly a huge chunk of the party. The right to petition government is inherent in our country's founding documents. But if it's not mentioned at all, and only incitement is given, the results are going to be the uplifted middle fingers, the profane shouts, of which there have been countless dozens, just in Waukesha County alone.
Well, and I experienced that myself. I've been out helping to collect signatures, and the thing that really stood out is the people who expressed such anger looked like they had been worked into just a blind rage. And again, as I said before, they were past the point of rational thought. They were angry, and I'm not even sure they understood why they were angry, and it was almost like they had been given their talking points and their marching orders, and when we tried to engage them in a meaningful conversation about the facts, they weren't in a position where they were capable of hearing facts. They were just in a state of blind anger. And I think that is a side effect of toxic talk radio.
It's a painful effect of talk radio. It denies us our civility, our essential dignity. Let's face it, extreme opinion radio spends a huge chunk of its time demeaning, debasing the large majority of the American population. If one realizes that that is the fare of extreme opinion radio and commercial ads, my goodness, we have a pretty bad recipe unless somebody wants to have a bitter, hating day.
Well, and I think it's brought about a transition in the discussion because I've spoken to a number of seniors who remember the Eisenhower era, for example, and they spoke of the fact that it was possible for them to sit down as Republicans with Democrats and progressives and independents and discuss an issue, whether it was the building of a local bridge, whether it was taxes, national defense, whatever, and have an intelligent exchange of ideas without it coming to middle fingers being raised and obscenities and all the rest. There was a certain level of intellect to the discussion, and they have commented that they've really seen things become increasingly polarized to a degree that they haven't seen before in their lifetimes. And I was wondering if you can give us your take on that.
Yes, I'm afraid it's far too accurate. Your words. The congressional baseball game that was between members of Congress, but also staffers. Those were collegial games. There was beer and pizza afterwards. There was a sharing of ideas. There was, you know, the same vigorous, reasonably serious sports competition out on the field. But there wasn't a demeaning of the value, the worth, before anything is said, the ideas of anybody who was on the other side. We have a very nefarious creature in this century, the last years of last century, and it's could be labeled many things, derision radio, resentment radio, but and my particular label happens to be extreme opinion radio, but its impact on us is far more than might be apparent. The way we think about ourselves.
I'd like to interrupt.
It's a massive change.
Sure, we have a few minutes left, and I would like you to address this point. It seems as though, and by all means, correct me if you disagree, that the kernel that is at issue winds up being a fear factor, and the rhetoric that toxic or divisive radio addresses is general to the point that it resonates with the general fear factors incumbent in most of the, well, let's face it, conservative listeners. And, you know, it means different things, but my impression is that it is used for two reasons. One, it is an excellent business model which generates fantastic advertising dollars for those businesses, for those mainstream media outlets that present this toxic talk, as well as a control element which ensures a solidification of their political base. As long as these people are kept in a certain level of fear and apprehension, they will always be voting for the conservative or Republican view. Case in point, people were offering up all of these crazy notions about the rail system, when in fact
the real issue when you got to start talking to them was the fact that they were afraid of brown people coming into the area. Now, you know, that is what it basically came down to. They escaped to rural areas in order to be away from people in general. And I think a lot of these folks don't share a certain level or a philosophy, in spite of their religious backgrounds, that they want to share and have a greater sense of community.
That's a highly interesting subject matter, and great fodder for many conversations. The business model, wanted to comment specifically on your business model thoughts. Advertising on Extreme Opinion Radio is appreciable, but it is limited. For example, advertising is almost completely shunned by the publicly held corporations. They have already realized its toxicity. And to the extent that progressives, Republicans, conservatives, Democrats refuse to accept, the mindless talk radio label, when it's in fact political message radio, every time that idea is conveyed, reconveyed, the advertising stream of those shows is certainly going to be diminished.
Well, Dick, I thank you so much for being with us this morning. We're out of time, and we need to transition to our next guest, but we would love to have you back to discuss this issue further. It's an important one.
Thank you both very much. It would be my pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you, Dick. And our next guest this morning is Lori Compass, who has been spearheading the Recall Fitzgerald movement. Lori, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. What can you tell our listeners about your efforts? Can you help bring us up to speed?
Sure. Well, the last number that we publicly released was that we had 12,000 signatures to recall Scott Fitzgerald, but we're still racking that number up, and I released the new number last night to a meeting of our best volunteers, and they are very excited about this movement, and we'll be announcing that, the new number after we count today, tonight at a strategy session in Beaver Dam. That'll be at 7:30 at the Dodge County Democrats office at 116 Monroe Street. So if you can make it out, you'll get to hear the latest count and hear how we're going to finish this off this weekend and over the coming week.
Outstanding. And how is the effort going in terms of the public perception? I know there were many who thought this couldn't be done, and that became sort of a problem at varying points in this effort, just the perception that it couldn't be done, when in fact, once you got out there with boots on the ground, you started finding considerable support for this recall. What can you tell us about that facet of it?
Yeah, I can't fathom why no one bigger than me took this on. I mean, I'm just I have a small business. I'm just kind of a normal person. I guess it is because they thought it couldn't be done. But living here in the district, I see the sentiment of, just so many people, Republicans, independents, Democrats, so many people look at Scott Fitzgerald and say, this guy isn't really representing us. He really needs to find a new job. So it's been growing great. The response from the volunteers has been amazing, and we've just rode this wave all the way in.
Fantastic.
That's great. Lori, I have a question for you.
Sure.
What kind of pushback have you encountered from Fitzgerald and, for that matter, Walker supporters? Because I did see, as did many others, see you on the YouTube clip on the Ed Schultz show, and I think that it's I think this really is a David and Goliath moment, with you being the David. And I was just appalled, as many people that I know, about Fitzgerald's response to you, especially with regard to making these crazy assertions, which they continue to do, about, you know, that there's going to be 500,000 Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck signatures that are going to be thrown out. And I know how diligent you are, as many of the volunteers have been, about ensuring that there are no repeat signatures, let alone goofy signatures, on these petitions.
Yeah, I just think it's preposterous for Fitzgerald to accuse us of fraud. And
so he never
apologized
to you.
I'm sorry? What was that?
He never apologized to you.
No, and you know, the apology wasn't that big a deal. What I wanted more than anything was him to admit that he was spreading lies about us and that those lies were leading to increased hostility against our volunteers, because I wanted that to stop. And, you know, we're good people. We don't deserve this. We're exercising our constitutional rights, and we're doing everything we can to be sure that our efforts reflect the will of the people. And he needs to publicly acknowledge that and call his people off. And he refused to do that. You know, I mean, he's a powerful guy. If he wanted to have a press conference tonight, every TV camera in the state would show up and film him saying, you know, just let these people go about their work. Let's all get along. Let's all agree to disagree. And he could have done that weeks ago, and he never did.
Well, and that touches on a point that has spilled over not only in the Fitzgerald recall, but the Walker recall as well, is that we haven't heard Scott Walker, the Fitzgerald brothers, or any of the Republican leadership coming forward and urging people. Now, we've heard about the raised middle fingers, the cries of obscenities, the physical acts of violence at recall stations. That's not representative of us. We'd really like to see you stop that. We're not hearing that from them. And they certainly could call off their own dogs, so to speak, if they chose to, and they simply haven't taken that opportunity to do so.
No, they haven't. But, you know, I want to say we've switched strategies. We're not really standing out on street corners anymore. Some of our volunteers choose to do that, and that's fine, but I just kind of realized several weeks ago that that wasn't getting us the numbers that we needed, and we had to go door-to-door. So now we're going door-to-door, and by the way, we've got a huge push coming this weekend, and we need as many boots on the ground as we can get. People can go to recallfitz.com and click on Help Us Out to find out how they can help. Anyway, going door-to-door, I found people are much nicer. You know, if people are in their cars, they've got that protective shell around them, and they'll flick you off, they'll yell at you. But I personally go canvassing quite a bit, and I have never had anyone be rude to my face. People will say they're not interested. People will say, absolutely not, I'm not going to sign that. But I've never had obscenities or, you know, people flicking me off to my face. So that's something that I want to stress to people, that when you're on someone's doorstep and you greet them with a friendly smile, it's a different experience than standing there waving a sign and having somebody drive by. We're finding it to be a much friendlier experience this way.
And I think you touched on a key point, that to get the numbers, the street corner approach, and that they're finding that in the recall walker effort as well, that standing on street corners isn't generating the numbers that it initially did, and that the door-to-door efforts are really helping people get closer to their goals a lot faster. So it's good to hear that your operation is doing that and it's going so well.
Yeah, and we've been doing it for quite a while, yeah.
If you were going to cite some specific things about Fitzgerald, specific policy decisions, specific things he's done that prompted this recall, what are a few of them that you would single out?
Well, in general, I think none of these divisive policies that supposedly came from Walker, and we're all trying to figure out exactly where they actually came from, you know, none of this would have happened if Walker didn't have his right-hand man in the legislature ramming things through. And, you know, it's it's his right to ram things through as long as he does, as long as he follows proper procedure. And for me, the turning point in all of this came on March 9th, 2011, when, I don't know if you guys remember, the meeting late in the evening wasn't given proper notice, broke the open meetings law. Peter Barker is standing there yelling at him that he's breaking the open meetings law, and they go ahead and do it anyway, and that paves the way for the passage of Act 10. I just, that was the moment when I thought, this guy's gone too far. No matter what you think about the policy, you have to follow procedure. And he's just, that's the moment when I realized he's not representing us honorably. This isn't fair. This isn't right. He needs to go.
And are you finding that that same sentiment is resonating with the people you're encountering throughout the district, that they share those same concerns?
You know, it, everybody has their own reasons for wanting to sign our petitions. We're finding a lot of people have just gotten their Badger Care benefits either completely cut or they're having to pay a lot more all of a sudden. And those people are just devastated by that. And so, you know, they're really eager to sign. Other people are, you know, members of unions, the corrections officers up in Dodge County. Those guys lined up on the first day to sign this petition. So, you know, there's a variety of reasons. But it just seems like no matter what I seem to care about, you know, whether it's mining up north or, you know, all these issues, he's just come down on the other side. And I just wish he would listen to us more.
That's been the keynote of his term in office from my perspective, is he seems to have almost an arrogance about him and almost a pridefulness that he is not listening. And it was evident in the meeting that you were featured in on the Ed Schultz Show. He just, it was clear, he was grinning and he was proud that he was being stubborn and bullheaded and he was not listening. And that seems to be one of his trademarks.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people have been forwarding me emails from him and stuff, and it does seem like people write him with their concerns, you know, and, you know, people don't take writing to a senator lightly. You know, they spend a long time researching what they want to say, making sure that it's presented in a logical way, and then they get a form letter back, and oftentimes it's, you know, has nothing to do with what their letter was about. And that's just really frustrating to people. And then you look at where his money comes from. More money comes from outside the state of Wisconsin for him last election than came from within his own district. So, you know, this is a guy who has, I think, maybe national aspirations. I don't know what his overall plan is, but he sure does have a lot of money pouring in from outside the 13th Senate District. And it just makes people wonder, you know, does he really care about us? Is he really listening to us?
Sure.
Well, let me
sure.
address something there, that there is a, speaking about his other intentions and the money coming in, there is a rumor, and for all of you listeners, again, it is a rumor, that the stepping stone for Scott Fitzgerald is to go beyond being a state senator and becoming a U.S. congressman, which means then his intention is to go ahead and allegedly look at running for James Sensenbrenner's seat, should Sensenbrenner retire or move on to other activities. So if that's not enough to see the damage that he has done to the 13th Senate District in the state of Wisconsin, if that's not enough to get a lot of people in the 5th Congressional District motivated, we would certainly enjoy or appreciate additional help in getting signatures to remove Scott Fitzgerald from office.
And again,
yeah,
could you repeat the information on where people can go to help out?
Sure. They can go to recallfitz.com. So that's recallfitz.com, and there's a button called Help Us Out, so click that, and it'll take you, you know, you can read a little bit about our amazing buttons that say, I helped recall Fitz, you might start seeing them crop up. People are starting to earn them. You have to get 10 signatures, and that's not easy. You know, out here in these small towns and rural areas, it can take 2 or 3 shifts to get 10. It's just, you know, you just have to accept that that's the way it is, and we've come a long way that way. But since we have so many people helping out, it, you know, obviously it adds up. So anyway, come on out to the district this weekend and earn your button. And, yeah, click on that link that says sign up here, something like that. Just sign up, and it'll take you to a form, and then you can choose. We've got 7 locations all around the district. Columbus and Beaver Dam are relatively close to Madison. We've also got a location in Oconomowoc, which is relatively close to Milwaukee. So, you know, we've come so far on our own, and this last weekend we really need to make a huge push. So if people could come in, like you said earlier, every Wisconsinite is affected by Scott Fitzgerald, and so we're really hoping that a lot of people take this plea to heart and come and help us out.
Okay, we will. Thank you so much for being with us this morning, Lori. We appreciate all that you're doing.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care. And folks, we're heading into a break, but please come back with us after the break and we'll continue our discussion.
Hello, I'm Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca with this week's Democratic Address. It's no secret that I strongly disagree with Governor Walker and the Republicans on massive cuts to public education, terminating 50 years of worker rights and their failure to focus on job creation. But there is one value that should transcend all the partisanship and division that plagues Wisconsin: clean, open, honest government that welcomes citizen participation. The secrecy and appearance of corruption that has marred Wisconsin government this past year leaves our state's reputation in tatters. And the abuses of power that took place during this secretive, dishonest approach to governing impact every other issue we face. This year began with the governor who stated he was dropping the bomb of effectively killing collective bargaining for public workers. He expected a rush vote without debate or scrutiny in less than 1 week. And he refused to sit down, look his employees in the eye, and to discuss it. And that approach of ramming policy through before people have had time to object was followed with abuses of power, such as putting the Capitol on lockdown, holding illegal meetings, and ending public hearings while citizens waited to speak. That was merely the beginning, consolidating rulemaking power at the top, replacing public employees with political cronies, proposing no-bid contracts, and pressuring the nonpartisan election board were just a few of the acts that followed. In this past month alone has brought us this news. First, top advisors to the governor have been granted immunity in an ongoing criminal probe involving state and federal authorities. Second, citizens prohibited from exercising their First Amendment rights to gather at state buildings, including the Capitol. Third, Governor Walker holding a press conference to take credit for lifting a cap on family care without ever mentioning the federal government mandated he do so. Fourth, the governor hiding his business schedule from citizens who pay a salary, even saying they do not have a right to know when he travels around the country to raise campaign cash. Fifth, revelations that a Supreme Court justice accepted the gift of free counsel from attorneys that regularly appear in his court and hiding that fact from the public. And finally, a scathing court ruling on redistricting that forces Republicans to share information they sought to cover up and sanctions them for their desperate attempt to hide the true nature of exactly what transpired in the redistricting process. What a month. And there were similar examples every month last year. I have always taken pride in Wisconsin values of honest debate and clean, open, and accessible government. Now, in the face of ethics questions, rule violations, dishonesty, allegations of corruption, and blatant abuses of power, I truly believe that Wisconsin democracy is at risk. No wonder people around the state are upset and fighting back. And it's not caused by extreme policies alone. It's about the disrespectful way their perspectives have been ignored and their participation cast aside. It's a backlash against these abuses of power. Whatever new and extreme policies Governor Walker and the Republicans choose to push in 2012, all the citizens of our state, regardless of party, must be given the time, information, and access to openly debate them. They deserve to know that their government is working for and with them, not for powerful special interest. This is how democracy works, and if the basic core tenets of democracy had been respected, we might not be starting 2012 as a divided and polarized Wisconsin.
All right, and we are back on the air, and
yes.
Our next guest,
Bill, I believe, Tom, our next guest is Robin Tranzo. Robin, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, well, it's pretty close. Tranzo. I'm married to Dane.
Tranzo.
So I can't. Yeah.
Okay.
Robin Tranzo.
And you are the executive director of InHealth Community Wellness Free Clinic in Boscobel, Wisconsin. And can you tell us about your efforts there? And I understand that you are not only located in Boscobel, but you have you're located in other areas, other cities or townships in that region. And not only that, I also heard a rumor to the effect that you were instrumental in developing the Scottiopoly game.
Yes. Well, I'll give you a little background on the clinic first, and then I'll tell you why the Scottiopoly game.
Certainly.
We, back in 2007, I had retired from teaching, and I guess I was isolated from, I had good insurance, and I retired early from teaching to spend time with our two adopted daughters, and I started seeing the suffering out here in our two counties of Grant and Crawford counties, and I got so angry. I felt that I needed to start a free clinic, and we did it in 6 months, and we had five doctors and everything you need. We raised $72,000, and we started serving. We have 2,500 patients. The following year, we started a Teeth for Life program that now serves 4,000 children in four counties around us because they don't have access to dental care. And, we just don't have very many dentists at all that will take Badger Care or Medicaid. So we had to start a dental prevention program. And now we're doing extractions and various things that can help our patients. A lot of people have extremely bad teeth because they don't have access. And then this happened in the state, and I knew that this was going to affect our free clinic, that once people were knocked off from Badger Care and Medicaid, we were going to have to, all of the free clinics in our state, were going to have to pick up the pieces. I mean, these people don't have any place to go except to a free clinic. And to make matters worse, most of our contributors are the middle class. You know, they're the people who they're the union workers, the teachers. So our contributions are less than they used to be. And I just, that was very upsetting. And I thought, as a teacher, when Scott Walker started saying that all of these people coming to the state were not, all these people that were at the protests were people from out of state, I thought, no, wait a minute, our young people need to know the truth. They need to know what is going on here, what happened in that first 100 days of office, and how it totally changed the history of our state, the progressive history of our state. And so I was on a walk with my dog one night and started, it just fell into my head. Maybe it's because I was an art teacher and I visualized things, but I could see how the Scottiopoli game could teach people history. It's kind of a bipartisan game. It's more of a historical game, and the Historical Society saw it as such and wanted it in the Historical Society. So we got together with the Wisconsin grassroots people, and they helped us produce that game. And part of the profits go to the free clinic to help me keep it running. But it's going to be a very, very tough year. Our numbers have already gone up by 268% just when people were dropped off the waiting list. And they haven't even been knocked off Badger Care and Medicaid yet. At the end of this month, I don't know what we're going to do if we can't keep our free clinics afloat. I don't know what these workers of the state that don't have access to health insurance, I don't know what they're going to do.
Well, and you're addressing an issue that came up during a fairly recent discussion with John Erpenbach, and the issue that was raised was the impact of cuts to Badger Care and other programs where, for some folks, that's the only access they have or it's their primary access. And Republicans have made the argument that this is just it would just be economically smart to just really significantly cut Badger Care, and John Erpenbach made the point that when you do that, people are left going to free clinics that are drastically overstrained, or they end up in the emergency room where the economic impact is just enormous. And I was wondering, can you talk at all about the economic impact of people not having access to health care?
Well, first of all, you know, protecting the rich just doesn't make sense when the rich get richer because of a healthy workforce, you know. And here we are not providing health care for our workforce. And that just doesn't make sense. Has Governor Walker thought about what kind of impact this is going to have on the health of the people of Wisconsin? And I'm not even talking about the poorest of the poor. I'm talking about the working poor. You know, he has not considered the fact, he hasn't given any safety nets or provided any additional help for those of us that are trying to find ways to help these people. There's hands full of us across the state. I mean, every free clinic has volunteers, but it's hands full of volunteers trying to serve thousands of people. And we don't have any resources, you know. John Erpenbach said he wasn't really sure if Scott Walker even thought about the poor. If he did, he wouldn't have done this. And that's a pretty sad thing when you think that this is the man who's supposed to be our father, so to speak. You know, he's supposed to think of all the people in the state, the workers, the poor, the rich, whatever. He's supposed to consider us all and represent us all, and he's not. He's not representing us.
It would be like being
a father in a family and abandoning your own children, you know?
Agreed.
Can bring people to court for that.
Robin, I agree with your points. Can you stay with us? We need to take a brief break, but we'd like to pick you up on the other side.
Absolutely.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
As an old country saying puts it, money is like manure. It does no good unless you spread it around. Yet, America's corporate and political leaders have intentionally been shoveling wealth into an ever bigger pile for those at the top. They've gotten away with this by lying to the great majority, which has seen its share of America's prosperity steadily disappearing. Yes, they've told us the rich are getting richer, but that's just the natural workings of the new global economy in which financial elites are rewarded for their exceptional talents, innovation, and bold risk-taking. Horse duties. The massive redistribution of America's wealth from the many to the few is happening because the rich and their political puppets have rigged the system. Years of subsidized offshoring and downsizing, gutting labor rights, monkey wrenching the tax code, legalizing financial finagling, dismantling social programs, increasing the political dominance of corporate cash. These and other self-serving acts of the moneyed powers have created the conveyor belt that's moving our wealth from the grassroots to the penthouses. Not since the Gilded Age, which preceded and precipitated the Great Depression, have so few amassed so much of our nation's riches. Having learned nothing from 1929's devastating crash, nor from their own bank failures in 2008 that crushed our economy, the wealthiest of the wealthy fully intend to keep taking more for themselves at our expense. This is Jim Hightower saying, now, however, the people are on to their lies. In an October poll, 2/3 of Americans support increased taxes on millionaires, an end to corporate tax subsidies, and policies to more evenly distribute the wealth we all help create. This rising egalitarianism shows the true American character and is changing our politics for the better. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And we're back. We're back with Robin Tronzu from Free Clinic out in Boscobel, Wisconsin, and it is the InHealth Community Wellness Free Clinic. She is the executive director. Thank you for holding with us, Robin. I think Tom had asked you a question, and please feel free to continue.
I've been thinking a little bit about what the wealthy can do for the poor. I mean, if they don't want their taxes raised, then why can't there be some way that they're required to assist situations like this? You know, when I say that our free clinic has increased by 268%, what that means is when we're open for 3 hours, we see close to 30 patients. We get 8 new patients every time we open our doors now. And of course, I lose sleep over this because I have no way of knowing how I'm going to keep this free clinic alive. You know, when you start something like this, it's like giving birth, and you are responsible for the health of these people. We have many chronically ill people with diabetes, high blood pressure. I mean, if these people don't get their medicine, their health is going to quickly deteriorate. And there must be some way that, I mean, if Governor Walker's going to do this, if he's going to cut these programs for these people, then he should work with the rich and say, listen, let's find a way to still provide health care, even if it isn't through...
Let me introduce this, and I actually have reservations about making this comment. It is political cynicism. I will admit to that. But in this increase of people that you have been seeing, unfortunately, many people believe that the right wing votes against its own best interest. And in that regard, do you see a lot of conservatives or people who supported Walker now coming into your clinic?
Mm-hmm. Well, we actually have a lot of people who come into the clinic who voted for Walker and now see the truth. Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, they see the truth because they feel it. They're impacted by this, and they had no idea that this was going to happen to them. You know, we have a correctional institution out here in Boscobel. It used to be called the Supermax Prison, and we have a lot of correctional officers who literally lost half of their paycheck. One of our correctional officers, who had worked for 30 years, opened up his first paycheck after the cut and had a heart attack. And I'm not exaggerating. This actually happened. The rescue squad had to come and get him out of the prison. And he had to take a month off from work. He could not believe how this impacted his family. I mean, he doesn't know how he's going to make his mortgage. And this is going on all across the state of Wisconsin. I just don't understand how Governor Walker couldn't have sat down for just a little bit longer and looked at how this was going to impact the people of the state. You know, you just don't do irrational things without thinking it through.
Well, Robin, that implies that he had the best interest of all of his constituents at heart. And this process over the last year has demonstrated that he does not, that he only has the best interest of a very, very small group of people, the majority of which are his donors from out of state. But as we are coming down to the last minutes of our show and your time, how is it that you see that people who are listening, who are sympathetic with you, who understand these issues, how can we help you?
Well, I would say, do you have quite a following? I mean, a lot of people can hear the show, I would imagine. And I would ask them to open their hearts because to the free clinics, because we're the folks that have to pick up the pieces from this and keep ourselves open in order to keep the health and well-being of the people of the state. And I would ask people to just consider donating to the free clinics.
Can you direct people to your website? Can you direct people to your website so that if they wish to help out, they can visit your website and explore that option?
Sure. Our website is www.inhealthcwc for Community Wellness Clinic.com. So www.inhealthcwc.com.
I thank you for sharing that. Absolutely. And we will direct our listeners to visit your site. And I thank you for the points that you've been making. Because one of my great frustrations in the healthcare discussion, some of the common Republican talking points that I've been confronted with have been things like, well, if people don't have healthcare, it's because they're lazy or they're just not bright enough to find another option. I've also heard the argument that if we completely eliminated Badger Care, it would save the state of Wisconsin so much money. The savings would just pour in and we would be overwhelmed by the tidal wave of budgetary health that we would enjoy as a state. And these are very clearly myths, and I think you've done a pretty good job of addressing them. And I hope you will continue to do so in your interactions with people around the state.
Thank you so much. Thank you for letting me speak, giving us a voice.
Yeah, you know, Robin, and again, we have a few more minutes, but one of the things that I have become aware of recently are people who suffer from various allergies, whether they are environmental or foodborne allergies. I would assume that those individuals, and there's a large population of them, would not be able to get their conditions addressed in a free clinic. Would that be accurate?
No, that's not accurate. We do primary health care. If we find someone that we just can't pin down what they're allergic to, we do have resources for secondary health care needs. And there's a clinic in Middleton, for example, called the BMP Clinic, Benevolent. Well, anyway, there's a clinic in Middleton that has doctors that come out from various hospitals, you know, rheumatologists, cardiac doctors and so forth, and they will sit down and visit with our free clinic patients. So we do have a place to send them, but it isn't always free. It's sometimes that puts a burden on that, that, you know, it can cost. And so we have to wheel and deal. And it's just like, if I have to find somebody to do a surgery for a patient, I may have to make an appointment myself with the surgeon. And literally, I have paid out of my own back pocket to sit down and talk to a surgeon about a certain patient. I have to get together a surgical team, get a volunteer anesthetist, or get the hospital to waive the cost in order to get this person help. And, I do everything I can to help these people. And it's not like I'm Mother Teresa or anything. It's just that I happen to be a Wisconsinite who cares about our people here. You know, I care about my neighbors. I have children. I know what it's like to see someone sick. I've been sick myself. And I think everybody...
So you epitomize what many people regard as very strong Judeo-Christian values in caring for your neighbor and your community as a whole.
Yeah, but
in spite of what benefit you would derive.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't just call it Christian values. I am open to all faiths, you know, and
of course,
and we serve all people.
I said that in order not to be too incendiary to some of our more sensitive listeners.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I mean, this is what we should all be doing. You know, we should all have a moral, wherever it stems from, sensitivity about, we should all be humanists, you know. And I think if everyone just helped one other person in some way, we wouldn't have a lot of these problems. Just one person helping another person. And I'll get contributors who will call in and say, you know, I'm not going to contribute to the clinic per se, but find me a person who needs help and I'll help that one other person. And I'm happy to hear people say that, because there's all kinds of people I can find for whoever wants to do that, you know, help one other family or help one other person. We should all do that.
Well, Robin, we are almost out of time. Could you repeat your website again just to make sure our listeners know where they can go to help you out?
Sure. It's www.inhealthcwc.com.
All right. Well, listen, Robin, thank you so much for being with us today. We would love to have you back again.
Oh,
yes, and Robin, I also want to express my gratitude for you doing God's work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thanks for letting me have a voice. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, sir, I think that's starting to wrap things up. I want to definitely thank you for participating today, Tom. I hope that Sarah is getting better. I thought we had a wonderful show, and look forward to seeing all of you again next week on the 13th, and hopefully Sarah will be back. And for those of you who prefer listening to her voice as opposed to mine and Tom's, you should be accommodated. So until then, thank you all, and have a great week.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, and Sarah, we hope you're back with us next time. Thanks for everyone who tuned in today. Thanks.
No, we won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it.